Well, we're almost through this chapter. I talked already about several exceptions to Mendelian genetics. That brings us up to 13, which is one that we haven't talked about yet. The name for this exception, it's an example of epistasis, which a lot of people mispronounce as epistasis, but it's epistasis. And the example here, as you see, uses rats. How many characteristics are we looking at here? What are they? And what else? What made you say two then? Okay, well, we're actually getting to that. There's only one characteristic here that we're looking at, which is coat color, fur color. And notice there are three traits, black, brown, and white. But I'm glad that you said what you did, because we've looked at examples where we paid attention to just one characteristic before, like the first one that we looked at, right? Pea plant flower color was just one characteristic. But when you have a diploid genotype for a single characteristic, it's usually just two letters, right? Two symbols, like upper P, lower P, or upper P, or lower P, lower P. And so you notice that these genotypes here have four letters, two kinds of letters, and two of each of those kinds of letters. So what does that tell you about these genotypes? What do genotypes in general tell you? What are genotypes a representation of? What does any given genotype, not just these, any given genotype represents what? What does the name tell you? Right? But specifically, what do the letters of a genotype tell you? Or represent, I mean. They correspond to traits, but what real molecular things do the letters represent?
Alleles,
that's right. That's what a genotype is. A listing of all the alleles for whatever gene you are concentrating on. You're just ignoring all the other genes. And so when all we were paying attention to was one characteristic and one gene that corresponds to that characteristic, it made sense that the diploid genotype was two letters long, like two P's or two W's or whatever. Here we have four letters, two B's and two C's. So that means there are how many genes involved? Two. There's the B gene and the C gene. But we are paying attention to only one characteristic. So that's what's unusual here. You have two genes, but only one characteristic is involved. And epistasis is a specific kind of gene interaction. Of course, you can't have gene interaction unless you're talking about more than one gene. So specifically what happens in epistasis is that the product of one gene, the protein product, that is, somehow affects the expression of a different gene. So let's explain that in terms of this specific example. The B gene here, for which there are two alleles, upper B and lower B, the B gene, depending on the allele, determines what the color of the pigment produced is in these rats. And there's two possibilities, black and brown. B stands for black. I know linguistically it stands for brown as well, but black. B stands for black because black is dominant over brown. So uppercase B means specifically the black version, the black allele, and lowercase b means the brown allele. Okay, so two possibilities. Either black pigment is produced or brown pigment is produced. And it's then deposited into the hairs, and that's what makes it look either brown or black to our eyes. But there's a second gene involved, which is the C gene. C stands for coloration. The protein product of the C gene, if it's the right allele, allows for the B gene to be turned on. Otherwise, the B gene will remain off. And there's two possibilities for the C gene, two alleles, uppercase C and lowercase C. The lowercase C does not make a protein product that can turn on the B gene. So it really does nothing in this case. But uppercase C is dominant over lowercase C, and the uppercase C allele, the dominant allele for the coloration gene, does make the correct protein product that will allow for gene B to be expressed, to turn it on, in other words. What this means, therefore, is that if a rat is homozygous recessive for the C gene, then that it's impossible for that rat's B gene to be turned on because it needs an uppercase C allele from the C gene to turn the B gene on. Therefore, if there are two lowercase c's, it doesn't matter what the B genotype is. None of that color, none of that pigment gets put into the hairs and they look white to us. On the other hand, if there's at least one uppercase C, then that will allow the B gene to be turned on, and then you look at the B genotype to see whether it's going to be black or brown, depending on the genotype. All right, does that all make sense? Epistasis. Oh, I don't have a picture for the next example, so just call this slide 13 and a half. The next one is pleiotropy. Another often mispronounced word. In some sense, not exactly, but in some sense, it's a little bit of the opposite of epistasis. Epistasis is multiple genes. I'm confusing myself. I'm getting ahead of myself. Pleiotropy is the situation in which a single gene affects multiple characteristics, two or more. And an example of that is an example that we've already looked at a couple times in this course, but for different reasons. That was the human sickle cell example. We looked at that because we were studying mutation and how it affects gene expression. But it's also, the sickle cell example is an example of pleiotropy, because that one gene, which is the hemoglobin gene, well, actually there are two hemoglobin genes, but the one that we looked at, that single gene has an effect on hemoglobin and whether it works to carry oxygen, but it also has an effect on the occurrence of the disease, whether you have sickle cell disease or not. So that's two totally different traits, right, affected by the same gene. So that's what pleiotropy is. Now we can go on to an example that we see have an actual picture for in slide 14. And this one is called, this example is called polygenic inheritance. Or this is an example of what we call polygenic inheritance. And what does the word polygenic tell you? Right. Multiple genes are involved. So in polygenic inheritance, a single characteristic is determined by multiple genes. And so this is where I was getting ahead of myself. Pleiotropy is one gene affecting multiple characteristics, so it's kind of like a divergence. Polygenic inheritance is like convergence because it's multiple genes all simultaneously affecting one characteristic. And the specific example here uses humans, specifically human skin color. So there's not one skin color gene is what the point is here. There are multiple ones. And I don't know how many exactly, but this figure pretends that there are six. Each of these little circles represents one of the skin color genes. I don't know that it's exactly six, but there's multiple skin color genes, though. And since there are several different genes involved, this is why there's not just one color or another possible. You know, it's foolish that we talk in terms of black and white. Not just for political reasons, it's foolish, but it's just biologically foolish. There's no such thing as a white person. There's no such thing as a black person. All humans are some shade of reddish brown. The reddishness comes from the fact that we see the blood through the skin, and the brown comes from the fact that melanin, the pigment, gets deposited in the skin cells. And how much melanin gets deposited, which is depends on the genes, determines the shade. So what's typical in polygenic inheritance, including skin color in humans, is that instead of there being just two or a few discrete possibilities, like red flower, white flower, pink flower, it's any value between two extremes. It varies along a continuum. So what's represented here is that you have these six genes, each of which can be the dark or light version, and depending on how many of them are light and how many of them are dark, determines the overall skin color. Polygenic inheritance. Okay, in 15, I hope you can recognize that these are the same type of plant, same species. Do you know what they are, by the way?
Hydrangeas.
Yes, good. And so these are not only the same species, they are the same species, but obviously they are different in their trait, of the trait for flower color. One is purple and one is pink and one is bluish. So that's no big deal. We've looked at this before, even with flower color, and you would expect, or you would be reasonable to expect, that these are just two individuals that differ in their alleles for the flower color gene. That would explain it in some instances, but not in this case. In this case, as far as the flower color gene is concerned, these two individuals are genetically identical. So how is it that genetically identical individuals can differ in their traits? Exactly right. Right. There's obviously a strong genetic component to phenotype. That's what we've been talking about all along. The genetic makeup definitely matters. But it's not the only thing that matters. Phenotype has a genetic component, but it also has an environmental component. What's happening around you affects you because your body is made up of things from your surroundings. In this case, the soil pH differed. And depending on what the soil pH is, it could be any of three different colors. Two are shown here. But if you think about this in human terms, it makes sense that there's an environmental component. If you have identical twins, which, remember, is an accident, really. It was supposed to be one zygote, and it split into two that developed independently, but they're genetically identical. Well, at birth, those identical twins are going to be very, very similar. But if they're separated and live separate 80-year lives in different places in the world doing different things, it's unlikely that they're going to be indiscernibly identical after those 80 years. And also, it just depends on what they do. It's not just the materials in the surroundings, which does make an effect. But, I mean, it's also experiences, right? One of them could be a bodybuilder, the other not. And that's going to make a big difference to their body that it has nothing to do with their genes. So, genetic component, environmental component. 16. I'm not going to spend too much time on the details of this because this is kind of an outdated thing, but I just want to tell you what it is. We're looking at pedigree analysis here. A pedigree is a family tree, like these ones drawn here for these humans. And pedigree analysis used to be much more important than it is now. If you think back to when I showed you that first test cross, that was for pea plants as an example. And I said the purpose of that test cross was to figure out the genotype of an individual with the dominant phenotype. Remember, you had the two possible Punnett squares, which are predictions, and then you just go ahead with crossing them to see which one comes true. Well, that's fine with pea plants, but you can't do that with humans for ethical reasons. And, you know, even if it were ethical, it would be a pain in the ass to work with humans, especially if you had to go through several generations, right? It would be a long wait. So, since you can't use humans for genetic studies, they used to do pedigree analysis, which is really just a logic game. You know, if a human has a recessive trait for some characteristic, that tells you, like it did for the pea plants, that individual is homozygous recessive, right? Which means that both of those parents had to have given that offspring a recessive allele. And therefore, if both parents are dominant, that would mean, by deductive reasoning, that both of those parents would have to be heterozygous because they have to have a recessive allele, otherwise they couldn't have a recessive child. But they have to have a dominant allele, otherwise they wouldn't have the dominant phenotype. So that's what all this pedigree analysis is about. You're just figuring out the genotypes by deductive reasoning. But the reason it's kind of outdated is that nowadays, it's fairly a routine thing to be able to just sample someone's DNA and figure it out conclusively. And speaking of genetic testing, 17 shows you two kinds of prenatal genetic testing that can be done. These are done for exactly the same purpose, just to get some DNA from the embryo or fetus, for the purpose of testing it to see, for whatever reason, like for instance, to see whether the fetus has a genetic disorder that will not allow it to survive, for instance. But for whatever reason, DNA is harvested. The only thing that's different about these two procedures, amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling, are when they are done. And the one on the left, amniocentesis, is actually later in the process, so they're switched with respect to time here. So this is a fetus already. And a fetus basically swims in amniotic fluid within the uterus. And as the fetus moves around, skin cells slough off and become mixed in that amniotic fluid. So you can get a sample of the fetal cells simply by drawing some of that fluid without actually poking into the fetus. Once you have some of those cells, then you can conduct genetic testing. The other one is chorionic villus sampling, which happens earlier on. Notice that this is labeled as a fetus. This is either an early fetus or a late embryo. And the sampling here is by suctioning off a chorionic villus. Remember villus as a word? Like we talked about villi that were in the small intestine. Villus is a general word that means finger-like projection. And these villi are part of the chorion, which is a layer in the placenta. Placenta is an interesting organ because it's simultaneously part of the mother and part of the fetus. It's where the exchange of materials takes place. Fetus gets fed through the placenta and the wastes get removed in the placenta from the fetus. But anyway, it's pretty easy to get in there without damaging anything. Just suction off a villus. That gives you the DNA and then you can conduct the tests. And it looks like that's it, because 18 and 19 are these typical summary slides. So I've mentioned all this stuff before, but I'm leaving it in there for you in case you want to study.